WTIC was but 10 years old when World War II began to erupt. The station's leadership, however, dated back to the years following World War I and was awake to the great responsibility that was destined to be shouldered by commercial radio, a dynamic medium of communication then in its infancy. How these responsibilities were met is a story in itself. Tonight we have sought to recall only the efforts of WTIC during the turbulent decade of World War II, the Second Cataclysm.
In commemoration of its 35th anniversary, this February 10th, 1960, WTIC presents a sound portfolio of actual broadcasts heard during that decade from 1935 to 1945. A documentary of radio's news coverage of that great conflict. These broadcasts were recorded for the permanent files of WTIC and are in no part taken from sources available to the public. Although many of the recordings lack the fidelity of present-day standards, we think you'll agree that they still were able to capture the heartbreaks, the sorrows, the joy, and the gladness which beset our generation just a short two decades ago. From WTIC's own vast library, these were the sounds of the Second Cataclysm.
1935, the SS Majestic returned to its berth in New York Harbor. Milton Cross, microphone in hand, waited to interview one of her passengers, the very distinguished Dr. S. Parks Cadman, returning from a conference in Europe.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am very glad to respond to the request of my old friend, Mr. Milton Cross, and to say that after 2 months spent in Europe, one returns home with sad forebodings for the future of that continent. It is again the zero hour for peoples who, though they dread war, invited by their flaming hates and jealousies. In states divorced from every vestige of self-control, the power to commit their manhood to mutilation and to death is wielded by an irresponsible tyranny, which at its best is freedom's foe, and at its worst an unforgivable guilt. The spiritual agony and material chaos created by the former conflict are utterly disregarded by despots who must popularize the illusion of their greatness or pass off the stage. They are of that lineage which wades through slaughter to a throne and to maintain it shuts the gates of mercy on mankind.
The paper that was the result of the Versailles Treaty had been tossed aside. The sweat and tears of the World War were buried in the desire for continued peace. Only the unscrupulous political agitators carefully, methodically used the paper as a whip to stir dissatisfaction within the nations who were disfavored by its terms. Benito Mussolini recruited Italy's discontented and violent nationalists, anti-communists, and disturbed political sadists. By October 1922, Mussolini had become Il Duce, the leader. Thus was Italy to follow the long road to the Second Cataclysm. In Germany, Adolf Hitler was forever bemoaning that Versailles Treaty's terms. Prevailing upon a sick and aging President Hindenburg, Hitler succeeded in concealing his ulterior motives and establishing himself as Chancellor of the State. The Italian-German snowball began to roll, and with it the beginning of the end to peace. Summer 1938, Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain flies to Germany to confer with Hitler. WTIC listeners heard this report on September 29th.
I realize vividly how Herr Hitler feels that he must champion other Germans, he told me privately. And last night he repeated publicly, that after this Sudeten-German question is settled, that is the end of Germany's territorial claims in Europe.
But by March 15, 1939, as Hitler's legions swept across what was left of Czechoslovakia, it was evident that Hitler had only been appeased, not satisfied, at Munich.
From Warsaw, Polish sources assert that German patrols had crossed the border into Polish territory at several points. They also assert that a German bomber had flown over Polish Silesia and had been pursued by Polish planes. Reports from Danzig of what Poles called new aggressive activity by Danzig Nazis included one that all communications between the Free City and the Polish port of Gdynia had been cut. Polish railway lines to Gdynia run through Danzig, and already Free City Nazis had occupied all the railway stations in Danzig territory.
Ladies and gentlemen, on this day, which may go down in history as the day when the Second Great World War began, WTIC brings you another of the interesting summaries by its own foreign affairs analyst, Professor Andre Schenker of the University of Connecticut. Professor Schenker.
This morning, as I speeded on to Hartford, I stopped at a roadside gas station to fill up, as we say. And as the man, the attendant, came out, he said to me, "Well, Mr. Schenker, they're at it." And a broad smile illuminated his face. Well, I suppose most of us were rather consternated when we learned the final news. Some of us may have feared another Munich. Some of us, realizing all the horrors of war, felt that most anything else is better than war. And although we realized that a crisis passed now might mean another crisis later, we could not help but fear what happened this morning with all sincerity. And when we learned of the conflict, well, we felt moved, we felt sorry.
September 1st, 1939, climaxed the fulfillment of what destiny had held back for 20 years, the destruction of the Versailles Treaty and World War II. Pleas to Hitler failed. England had decided.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
2 weeks later, on September 17th, the Russian bear fed on what was left of free Poland.
Hello, NBC. This is Howard Klaney in London.
It's 1 o'clock.
And although the press here this morning states that Russia's move into Poland was not unexpected, it is frankly admitted here that it's a serious blow. Columns are devoted to speculations on Russia's real reason for her aggressive act of so-called protection. All editorials say that beyond this pretext, the true reason is obscure.
Hitler reaped his revenge on Poland after refusing to concede him the Polish corridor. The people were German, he said. They should be a part of Germany. Actually, less than one-tenth were German. A triumphant Hitler followed his troops into Poland. He spoke at Danzig. It was September 18th, 1939.
We take you now to Danzig.
Danzig, Grüßten Führer! Adolf Hitler, Sieg! Sieg! Sieg!
Ein halbes Jahrtausend länger ist dieser Boden deutsch. Gewesen, war deutsch geblieben und wird, dessen können alle überzeugt sein, deutsch bleiben.
Hitler commenced his speech by saying that this great moment was not being only experienced by the citizens of Danzig, but also by all of the German people.
Poland capitulated on October 12, 1939. The antiquated Polish army proved no match for the modern mobile Wehrmacht. On April 9th, Hitler's legions landed in Norway. Denmark was overrun in a day. Like a spider spinning its web, the Germans had struck in two directions, and its tentacles were soon to spread west to France. An aroused English lion demanded action.
I sought an audience of the king this evening and tendered to him my resignation, which his majesty has been pleased to accept. His majesty has now entrusted to my friend and colleague, Mr. Winston Churchill, the task of forming a new administration on a national basis. And in this task, I have no doubt he will be successful. And you and I must rally behind our new leader, and with our united strength and with unshakable courage, fight and work until this wild beast that has sprung out of his lair upon us be finally disarmed and overthrown.
The minister who failed to secure peace in our time at Munich gave way to Winston Churchill, first Lord of the Admiralty. It was May 10th, 1940. Churchill promised blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Our only aim is victory, he said, for without victory there is no survival. The world waited as the German invader closed the vise around France. Nearly crippled, France staggered to its knees. Then a report from Rome. It was June 10th, 1940.
Mussolini began. Combatants on land, sea, and in the air. Black shirts of the revolution and of the legion. Men and women of Italy, of the empire, and of the kingdom of Albania. Listen. An hour, signed by destiny, is ticking on the skies of our country. An hour of irrevocable decisions. A declaration of war has been given to the ambassadors. To the ambassadors of France and England.
It was disclosed that Italian forces had marched into France through the Riviera at 6:30 p.m. Rome time, or 12:30 p.m. New York time. The Associated Press said this information was given out just before a statement was to be made by von Ribbentrop. This Italian invasion of France came just 30 minutes before Mussolini's speech declaring war.
An embittered American president spoke.
This 10th day of June 1940, the hand that held the dagger has struck it into the back of its neighbor.
By May 18th, 1940, the Belgians had abandoned Antwerp. The channel ports of Boulogne and Calais fell on May 22nd. Only Dunkirk was left. The spell of gloom drifted over the civilized world. Prime Minister Churchill described what must have been felt by every man in Britain.
What General Zagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
The Battle of Britain had begun. The German Luftwaffe was ordered to destroy London, paralyzed the British will to fight on alone. An open BBC microphone carried to the world the horror that filled the air over London that September. But England was not to stand alone for long. The new world had begun to stir. President Roosevelt, October 16th, 1940.
Men and women of the United States, on this day, more than 16 million young Americans are reviving the 300-year-old American custom of the muster. They are obeying that first duty of free citizenship by which from the earliest colonial times every able-bodied citizen was subject to the call for service in the national defense. It is a day of deep and purposeful meaning in the lives of all of us. For on this day, we Americans proclaim the vitality of our history, the singleness of our will, and the unity of our nation. We prepare to keep the peace in this new world, which free men have built for free men to live in.
We are in the presence not of local or regional wars, declared Secretary of State Cordell Hull, but of an organized and determined movement for steadily expanding conquest. On October 29th, President Roosevelt pulled the first draft number since World War I from that celebrated bowl.
As each capsule is drawn, it will be opened, and its number read over the radio to the listening nation. The first number drawn by the Secretary of War is serial number 158.
And 4 months later, on February 24th, 1941, our own 43rd Division was activated into federal service.
Division mobilizes. Ladies and gentlemen, come what may, this date, February 24th, 1941, will go down in New England's history as one of the most memorable. For today, the largest National Guard division in the country, comprising the states of Maine, Vermont, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, mobilizes for a year's training in the interests of national defense. The 172nd Field Artillery of New Hampshire also mobilizes today, as does the 118th Observation Squadron of Connecticut. At this moment, in 95 armories throughout New England, men in khaki are being inducted into the federal service. Since the early hours of the morning, steady streams of men have been converging upon their company headquarters. By train and plane, by automobile and afoot, from the southernmost corner of Connecticut to the northernmost tip of Maine, where snowshoes were the vehicles of transportation, men of New England are answering a presidential order, which will soon entrain them for camp landing in Florida. A dozen northeastern radio stations are carrying this part of the induction ceremonies to crowded armories, where loudspeakers will bring the men the voices of high-ranking officers. It is now our privilege to present to you the commanding general of the 43rd Division since its inception, Major General Morris B. Payne.
I want particularly to address my remarks to the 12,000 officers and men of the division and to the families and friends of each member of the division. Today we have voluntarily assumed a new obligation. By command of the President of the United States, we are now on active duty status.
Early British victories in Africa were short-lived with the arrival of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps. From June 15th to the 17th, 1941, efforts to relieve the battered rats of Tobruk proved disastrous to the British. If the German invader was to come, said Churchill, it was surely to be now.
This is the BBC Home, Forces, and Overseas program. Listeners at home and all over the world are now to hear the Prime Minister of Great Britain. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Churchill.
I have taken occasion to speak to you tonight because we have reached one of the climacteric of the war. At 4 o'clock this morning, Hitler attacked and invaded Russia.
Hitler hoped to neutralize Britain and America by presenting his attack on Russia as a crusade against Bolshevism. It was the old dream of Munich, but Hitler found that his enemies could no longer be divided by the specter of communism. Lend-Lease, the Atlantic Charter, the Four Freedoms, new expressions that were to lend hope to a world without peace. America was caught up in that world on December 7th, 1941.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked the Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air. I'll repeat that. President Roosevelt says that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii from the air. This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York.
War came on Sunday. The president spoke to Congress on Monday.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Quickly overrunning Bataan, the Japanese began their assault on our garrison on Corregidor. We held with tenacity and valor. An Army radio operator in San Francisco picked up this message from the besieged defenders on May 5th, 1942.
They are not near yet. We are waiting for God only knows what. How about a chocolate soda? Not many. Not near yet. Lots of heavy fighting going on. We've only got about 1 hour, 20 minutes before we may have to give up by noon. We don't know yet. They are throwing men and shells at us, and we may not be able to stand it. The white flag is up. Everyone is bawling like a baby.
Corregidor and its three companion forts fell on May the 6th, 1942.
This is Lieutenant General Wainwright. Subject, surrender. It became apparent that the garrisons of their forces would be eventually destroyed by aerial and artillery bombardment and by infantry supported by tanks which have overwhelmed Corregidor. After leaving General Hummel with no agreement between us, I decided to accept in the name of humanity, his proposal, and tendered at midnight, not 6-7 May 1942, to the senior Japanese officer on Corregidor, the formal surrender of all American and Philippine Army troops in the Philippine Islands. You will therefore be guided accordingly and will, repeat will, surrender all troops under your command to the proper Japanese officer. This decision on my part, you will realize, was forced upon me by means entirely beyond my control.
The loss of the Philippines was the sorriest defeat this country ever suffered abroad. But as a delaying action, the campaign was a success. Bataan and Corregidor, like Valley Forge, were triumphs of American courage.
The Alka-Seltzer National Barn Dance program will be delayed a few moments so that the National Broadcasting Company may bring you an important war bulletin just released. Here is Morgan Beatty speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
Good evening. The story of Pearl Harbor can now be told on the first anniversary of the Japanese sneak attack. Here it is in outline. 8 United States battleships were crippled, every capital ship in the harbor. 2 of them were sunk. 11 other naval vessels were also seriously damaged. 177 American planes were destroyed on that black day. And worst of all, on December the 7th, a year ago, 3,303 sailors, soldiers, and Marines were killed or they're still missing.
But if we were still weak in sea power, we made the most of what we had. Desperate attacks by American destroyers running at top speed laid waste a Jap convoy en route to Java. At the Battle of Midway on June 6, 1942, the balance of naval power that had been lost at Pearl Harbor was regained. And across the world, we had landed in Africa.
It's 10 o'clock, and here is the news you've been waiting for. Franklin D. Roosevelt and Winston Churchill have met on the soil of Africa at Casablanca. There, not far from the noise of war, they drew up battle plans for 1943, plans designed to bring about the unconditional surrender of Germany, Italy, and Japan.
At Casablanca, on January 14, 1943, the Union agreed upon at earlier meetings between President Roosevelt, Prime Minister Churchill, Premier Stalin, and Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek was made firm. We were determined to fight to achieve unconditional surrender of the enemy. The United Nations had begun to take form. The strategic initiative had been snatched from the enemy at Guadalcanal, in New Guinea, at El Alamein, Stalingrad, and in Tunisia. WTIC's radio audience knew that when they heard the standard time tone on the hour, the station's clocks had corrected themselves to split-second timing, and it was truly that hour. On July 14, 1943, WTIC's listeners heard a new sound, a sound that was to serve as a symbol for a hopeful world. WTIC's familiar time signal was born of a wish for victory. That signal was the Morse code di-di-di-da for the letter V, which henceforth would characterize a trademark on the hour, symbolizing broadcasting with responsibility. Italy, weary of war, her entire African empire taken from her, wobbled to capitulation. The official announcement of unconditional surrender came from the Allied commander, General Eisenhower. It was September 8th, 1943.
This is General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Commander-in-Chief of the Allied Force. The Italian government has surrendered its armed forces unconditionally.
Prime Minister Churchill hailed the victory.
The successful campaign in Sicily brought about the fall of Mussolini and the heartfelt repudiation by the Italian people of the fascist creed. Mussolini indeed escaped to eat the bread of affliction at Hitler's table, to shoot his son-in-law, and to help the Germans wreak vengeance upon the Italian masses whom he had professed to love and over whom he had ruled for more than 20 years. This fate and judgment, more terrible than death, has overtaken the vainglorious dictator who stabbed France in the back and thought that his crime had gained him the empire of the Mediterranean.
Mussolini's time had not yet come. Captured by partisans and held at Abruzzi, he was quickly rescued by daring Nazi parachutists and spirited away to his German overlord. The German had lost the power to mount a sustained offensive after the defeat at Stalingrad in the winter of 1943. What reserves he had left, he would need in France to oppose the inevitable invasion. As the world waited, England inflated with men and materiel. 12:41 a.m. Eastern Wartime, June 6th, 1944.
The German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. I repeat, the German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. There was no Allied confirmation.
3:15 a.m. Eastern Wartime.
The German DNB agency said today in a broadcast, which is unconfirmed from Allied sources, that six heavy warships and 20 destroyers are lying before the Seine estuary off the coast of France.
The first communique came at 3:32:09 a.m. Eastern Wartime.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
At 3:36:57 a.m. Eastern Wartime, this was the order of the day.
The following is the order of the day, issued today by General Eisenhower to each individual of the Allied Expeditionary Force. Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeat in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Finally, at 3:48:58 a.m. Eastern Wartime, June 6, 1944, a dramatic announcement by the Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of a concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching. All patriots, men and women, young and old, have a part to play in the achievement of final victory. To members of resistance movements, whether led by nationals or by outside leaders, I say, follow the instructions you have received. To patriots who are not members of organized resistance groups, SELFO, continue your happy resistance, but do not needlessly endanger your lives. Wait until I give you the signal to rise and strike the enemy. the day will come when I shall need your united strength. Until that day, I call on you for the hard task of discipline and restraint.
To recall those anxious days, days when American, French, British, Canadian, Belgian troops fought for every inch of beach, would require a whole chapter in history to relate. The going was tough, but the same tenacity and speed the German had demonstrated in 1940 was equally duplicated by Allied armor, so that by late August 1944, Paris began to breathe the fragrance of liberation. On August 26, 1944, General Charles de Gaulle entered the city. But the German had not completely left.
This is London calling. Robert Reed, BBC correspondent, was standing outside the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris yesterday, describing the scene as General de Gaulle arrived for the Te Deum. Here is a recording of what ensued.
The generals now turned to face the square and this huge crowd of Parisians who is being presented to people. It's being received. It's being received. Even while the general is marching, into the cathedral. No. Well, that was one of the most dramatic scenes I've ever seen. Just as General de Gaulle was about to enter the Cathedral of Notre Dame, firing started all over the place. I'm afraid we couldn't get you the noise of that firing because I was overwhelmed by a rush of people who were trying to seek shelter and my cable parted from my microphone. But I fell just near General de Gaulle and I managed to pick myself up. General de Gaulle was trying to control the crowds rushing into the cathedral. He walked straight ahead into what appeared to me to be a hail of fire from somewhere inside the cathedral, somewhere from the galleries up near the vaulted roof. But he went straight ahead without hesitation, his shoulders flung back, and walked right down the central aisle, even while the bullets were pouring around him. It was the most extraordinary example of courage that I've ever seen.
As the United Nations' closing vice tightened around Nazi Germany, America kept one ear to her radio.
This is John McVane in Germany. Armored columns of the 1st American Army today leaped 40 miles forward. They entered Nordhausen, only 115 miles from Berlin, 53 miles from the Elbe. Today's advance puts the 1st Army neck and neck with General Patton's 3rd Army in the race for the honor of the first meeting with the Russians. The nearest Russian forces are 120 miles away from both our armies. The 1st Army's 3rd Armored Division that rolled up the 40-mile advance today has previously made 101 miles in 24 hours when it raced east and north and closed up the Ruhr Pocket. This is John McVane returning you to NBC in New York.
And as Allied troops crossed the western frontier of Germany, their supreme commander, General Eisenhower, issued a proclamation to the German people. We come as conquerors, but not as oppressors. We shall overthrow the Nazi rule, dissolve the Nazi party, and abolish the cruel, oppressive, and discriminatory laws and institutions which the party has created. We shall eradicate that German militarism which has so often disrupted the peace of the world.
The American Ninth Army has reached the Elbe River at a point 64 miles from Berlin today. The Elbe, last water barrier before the German capital, was reached at Magdeburg by tanks of the 2nd Armored Division. The 2nd, or Hell on Wheels, has scored advances up to 55 miles during the day to outdistance other American troops driving for a union with the Russian forces. 3rd Army troops also broke loose today and captured the city of Coburg, 49 miles from the border of Czechoslovakia. Also captured today were the cities of Essen and Brunswick.
With final German capitulation in sight, an elated world was suddenly, unexpectedly brought tragic news. It was late afternoon, April 12th, 1945.
We take you now to NBC in Warm Springs, Georgia.
News of the death of the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This room, this press and radio room at the moment, as you can well understand, is a scene of great confusion. The shock of the news is somewhat difficult to bring to you in words. I have seen in the last hour veteran correspondents break into tears when the news was officially announced by the presidential secretary, Stephen Early. The official announcement ran along these lines. President Roosevelt passed away this afternoon at Warm Springs, Georgia, at the home which was affectionately called the Little White House. The president was having his portrait painted at the time, a portrait as yet unfinished, when he fainted away at 3:05 this afternoon.
The eulogies which followed President Roosevelt's death were many and eloquent. And for the second time in radio's short history, a president died while still in office, Warren G. Harding having been the first on August the 2nd, 1923.
The Honorable Harry S. Truman was sworn in this evening as President of the United States by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Harlan F. Stone, at exactly 7:09, about 2 minutes ago. Mr. Truman uttered the words, "I do," and became the 33rd President of the United States.
Harry S. Truman was left with an enormous task, shouldering the responsibility of a great American leader. But the war went on. The vice closed shut on a beaten Wehrmacht. It was 7:55 p.m. Eastern Wartime, April 28, 1945.
The National Broadcasting Company delays the start of all its programs to bring you a special bulletin. It was announced in San Francisco half an hour ago by a high American official not identified as saying that Germany has surrendered unconditionally to the Allies, no strings attached, and that the announcement is to be made formally by General Eisenhower. I'll repeat that. The formal announcement has not yet been made, but the official says that Germany has surrendered unconditionally to America, Britain, and Russia.
Here comes the Daz Show!
Truth, the consequences!
Let her go!
D-U-Z.
Hello there, we've been waiting for you. It's time to play Truth or Consequences. Yes, Truth or Consequences, the game that does everything on the air. Brought to you by Dove, the soap that does everything in your wash. And here he is, that hat.
NBC interrupts all its programs to bring you a special bulletin. We take you now to New York.
A bulletin from Washington. The White House said tonight at 8:30 p.m. Eastern wartime that no official confirmation had been received on reports that Germany had surrendered unconditionally, but that if such a confirmation came, President Truman would issue a proclamation and read it over the radio. Secretary Early received the newsmen shortly before 8:30 p.m. and said, "There has been no official confirmation yet. The War Department has no confirmation. The map room has no confirmation. As soon as we get official confirmation, the president will read the proclamation over the four networks."
This bulletin came to you from the NBC newsroom in New York. Keep tuned to your NBC station for later news.
But America and the Allied world had to wait. Germany held out until May 8th. President Truman made the announcement.
"For the triumph of spirit and of arms which we have won, and for its promise to the peoples everywhere who join us in the love of freedom, it is fitting that we as a nation give thanks to Almighty God who has strengthened us and given us the victory."
Prime Minister Churchill made the announcement to a thankful England that same day.
"The German war is therefore at an end. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. The injuries she has inflicted upon Great Britain, the United States, and other countries, and her detestable cruelties call for justice and retribution. We must now devote all our strength and resources to the completion of our task, both at home and abroad. Advance, Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom! God save the king!"
As Germany died, so did its leaders. Tales of Hitler's Berlin bunker death were many. Heinrich Himmler, the hated SS chief committed suicide. Goering, Hess, Dyrnitz, and other Wehrmacht officers were captured and held for trial. Benito Mussolini, having escaped the partisans once, finally fell before them. NBC correspondent George Grimm was there.
Satisfying as well as exciting was a bright Sunday morning in Milan, Italy, just 2 weeks ago. In our lone jeep, we shot along the Mussolini highway from Verona to Milan. No Allied army had gone this way yet. Milan, they said, was in the hands of the Italian partisans. We passed one roadblock after another, manned by the partisani, with plenty of rifle power. Incidentally, we took two of them aboard as a password. Then our jeep, which was daintily named Minneapolis, Maryland, entered northern Italy's largest city. It was Mussolini Sunday. The Milanese thought that we were the vanguard of American troops. Tens of thousands of them tried to get into our jeep. They kissed it and us. Flowers, wine, cheers, singing. There were 18 people on our jeep at one time, including four riflemen sighting at upper windows for Nazi snipers. Somehow or other, our jeep got to the Piazza Loreto. And there, hanging by his ankles from a filling station overhang, was the strutting shadow of the Caesars, Benito Mussolini, shot and then strung up so all could see. Il Duce, his last mistress, and more than a dozen of his fellow gangsters. The people of Milan swept us on. Mussolini was past. We were the Allies, the people they had been waiting for.
With Europe secure, we threw all our strength to the Pacific. The United Nations vice soon closed around Japan. Manila, capital of the Philippines, February 25th, 1945. General MacArthur.
More than 3 years have elapsed. Years of bitterness, struggle, and sacrifice. Since I withdrew our forces and installations from this beautiful city, on behalf of my government, I now solemnly declare, Mr. President, the full powers and responsibilities under the Constitution restored to the Commonwealth, whose seat is here reestablished as provided by law. Your country thus is again at liberty to pursue its destiny to an honored position in the family of free nations.
On April 1st, 1945, Marines stormed ashore on Okinawa.
This is Bud Foster speaking from Okinawa. American forces pushing south toward the capital city of Naha on this doorstep of Japan now plainly see the work cut out for them. Full-scale Japanese resistance has been met all the way across the 7,000-yard-wide neck of land over which large numbers of army troops are slowly pushing forward. The big southern bulge of Okinawa Island is crammed with Jap troops and civilians. And by the amount of artillery, mortar, and small arms fire they're throwing at our positions, they must be well equipped with ammunition. Once again, it's the same old story. Caves, pill boxes, the Japs dug in deep where it takes flamethrowers and automatic rifles to silence them forever, and your artillery alone can't do the job no matter how much you bring into action. So now, in an area roughly 10 miles square, that's larger than all of Iwo Jima, and the terrain is almost as tough, every Jap soldier and every recently recruited civilian carrying arms, a number which may amount to 100,000 men altogether, stand in the way of our complete victory here at Okinawa Jima.
Blows against the Japanese fleet continue to their last place of refuge, the Kure Naval Base on the inland sea.
Admiral Nimitz announced a few minutes ago the results of our carrier strike raid during the last 2 days against the great Japanese naval base of Kure. And here they are. Our planes left two large Jap battleships burning. One large aircraft carrier was left in flames. Two large cruisers and one light cruiser were heavily damaged. Admiral Nimitz says that the battleships were of the EC class, heavy battleships converted into aircraft carriers by conversion of the after structure into a small flight deck. The heavy cruisers damaged were the Tone class, and the light cruiser was of the Oyodo class. Let me repeat, two large Jap battleships, one aircraft carrier were set afire at Kure, and two heavy cruisers were caught, were heavily damaged. This bulletin came to you from the NBC Newsroom in New York.
At 10:45 a.m. Eastern Wartime on August 6, 1945, President Truman made the dramatic announcement that we had dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. On August 8th, Nagasaki fell victim to this awesome new weapon.
Come in, Guam. Go ahead, George Thomas Folster.
This is George Thomas Folster at Advanced Fleet Headquarters on Guam. Rumors, compelling rumors of peace are in the air. Atomic bombs devastating Japan's important war industrial centers, and Russia is in the war. Maybe we will understand why the pressure has increased so strongly if we listen to Newsweek's Bob Shetland's recorded report of his exclusive eyewitness account for NBC of the atomic destruction of Nagasaki. Go ahead, Bob Shetland.
This is Robert Shetland reporting from Okinawa. I have just seen at first hand what America's new secret weapon, the atomic bomb, can do to a Japanese city. At 10:30 o'clock Thursday night, 12 hours after the second such bomb was dropped, this time on Nagasaki, I rode over the scene of destruction in a four-motored Liberator of the 5th Air Force. We were out on a night bombing run looking for enemy shipping. On our way up north, we passed within a few miles of what was left of Nagasaki. We began seeing it 100 miles away, first as a thin white line on the black horizon. I nudged pilot Fred Muller and shouted over to him, "What do you think it is?" He shrugged his shoulders and talked to the navigator. A moment later, the navigator came back on the phone. "That's Nagasaki. That's the place they dropped another of those magic eggs today." Muller swung the plane over toward the line of light. It was a clear night and the stars were out. Muller was taking no chances. All of us wanted to get a look at the cauldron, but the orders were out for planes to stay away. After we got within 10 miles of the city, we swung northwest along a hill ridge near the coast. It was like looking over the rim of a volcano in the process of erupting. Remember, this was already 12 hours after the B-29 had dropped the atom bomb. And I can report that Nagasaki was still a mass of angry flame and smoke.
At 7:35 a.m. Eastern Wartime, on August 10th, 1945, the official Japanese Domai News Agency broadcast an announcement that they would accept the terms laid down in the Potsdam Declaration, provided the sovereignty of the emperor was not questioned. The world was excited. Was this it? We waited while our leaders debated.
Go ahead, Bob.
This is the NBC newsroom in New York. Flash, Washington. President Truman has just announced that Japan has accepted the surrender terms of the Allies.
Final surrender came at 7 p.m. Eastern Wartime, August 14th, 1945.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Richard Harkness, who was at the press conference and press with Ralph Howard Peterson, has now gone to our contact point at the White House gate, where he will read you President Truman's announcement to the world a few moments ago.
And this is Richard Harkness in Washington. I've just come from President Truman's historic peace conference, and I'm now broadcasting to you from the White House grounds. Now, you heard the flash, I am sure. The Japanese offer of unconditional surrender is official. It has been accepted. We were ushered into the president's big Oval Office promptly at 11 o'clock, as I should say, 7 p.m. Eastern Wartime tonight. President Truman sat there in a dark blue suit. He read to us in an official tone this statement by the President of the United States. President Truman said this, "I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government in reply to the message forwarded to that government by Secretary of State Burns on August 11th. I deem this reply," the President told us, "a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan."
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is WEKW, the shortwave transmitter of WTIC, and we're broadcasting from downtown Hartford. This is Floyd Richards and Ross Miller and myself are down here, and the atomic bomb of jubilance has just burst in downtown Hartford. People are running around,
throwing papers, children are blowing horns, and, well, everything is happening. You probably can get a small idea of what is happening by listening to the horns and the people shouting in sheer jubilation that the war is finally over. We all know that you heard our president's announcement not more than a half hour ago, and still has not struck its full force down here. We're sure of that. The space of street between, I would say, Pratt Street and all the way down to South Green on Main Street is just thronged with people. Every person that makes up a people of a nation is down here, and everyone is, well, just really and truly happy that this thing has finally gone over. We are parked right now, held up for the moment by a traffic light, at the corner of Pearl and Main Streets. People are just standing on the curb, some of them hollering at the top of their lungs, others just standing there and looking, not quite able to grasp the significance of this great occasion. There goes a car now with two sailors perched atop it, and they're just laughing and receiving all the plaudits of the crowd. They're throwing out paper. And there are three girls in the front seat. I don't know whether they all know each other or not, but they certainly will before the night's over, because everybody is just as happy. And there goes five more up on the car. Now there are five girls and two boys, and I might add the boys don't seem to mind it a bit. Cars are just jammed here on Main Street. We're in back of about five buses. They can't move. The cars can't move. The people can't move. Everyone is too crowded, and no one cares a bit. Well, here's Ross Miller. Maybe he can give you a few more reactions down here in downtown Hartford.
Thank you, Floyd. Good evening, everyone. It's interesting to note the expressions on the faces of the people lined along the streets here, Main Street, Hartford, Connecticut. At the present, we're at the intersection of Asylum Street and Main Street, Hartford. Buses going to the left of us, cars on the right, throngs of people, some just standing around watching everyone else. There's a car, a man at hand.
It was over. The prophecy of Dr. Cadman as he embarked from the SS Majestic in 1935 had been fulfilled, and radio had had its baptism. You heard it over WTIC, the second cataclysm.
In commemoration of WTIC's 35th anniversary, we have presented the second cataclysm, a sound portfolio of World War II. Recordings heard were from WTIC's own library. The second cataclysm was written and produced by Paul Gianfrido. It was narrated by Dick Bertel. This is Bruce Kern.